From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Michael Martinez, sitting in today for Kodwo Namdi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist for the current newspapers. You can see him in action on the video stream right now on our Facebook page. We've got a lot to do today, Tom. In just a few moments, we'll be talking with Eleanor Holmes Norton. But there's a lot of transit news this week. And first, I want to ask you about something that Elon Musk was tweeting about that he got permission from someone to explore. It's called the Hyperloop, and I want you to tell me about it. I'm interested.
Well, first of all, Elon Musk, you know, he's a futuristic guy. Let's give him that credit. Although I do, you know, when I hear his name, Elon Musk, I always think of some cheap men's fragrance at CVS. And I apologize because I think names are important. I really like names, but that's... And so it's hard for me to get past that. He wants to build these hyper fast trains in California from San Francisco.
Can
to
I
Los
read
Angeles.
His tweet just so that people
the
can
tweet
know
about what he's now his big plan?
All right. So this was the first tweet that went out yesterday. Just received verbal government approval for the Boring Company to build an underground NY Philadelphia Baltimore DC Hyperloop. New York to D.C. in 29 minutes. First of all, what's the Boring Company? The Boring Company
the boring
is his company?
The Boring Company would do it's not boring as in it's dull.
Well, speaking
it's
of names, that has a funny name.
Tunnels, yes. Everything's funny about this. Well, it's futuristic, but here's the deal. He wants to be able to make these trains that go on air, pockets of air, from here to New York and back. 29 minutes. He tweeted this. Everyone went crazy about, oh, this is great. What's the approval? What's the approval? Well, as far as we can tell, as of this moment, I know of no approval. Somebody somewhere gave
Someone.
Him verbal approval. That doesn't mean anything in Washington. Virginia hasn't heard anything about it. Maryland hasn't heard anything about it. The mayor here said she hasn't heard anything about it. They all would like something because here's the fact. The serious fact is we need to improve our mass transit between mm-hmm. cities, our urban centers.
And but there was some news about this early this week on separate issues. The federal appeals court on Wednesday ruled that it would allow Maryland to begin building the Purple Line while a lawsuit opposing it continues. So that was big news.
Right. That's here and now news as mm-hmm. opposed to this futuristic
pie in the sky in the future.
I think I went to the Union Station yesterday to wrap that up, and everybody would like to get to New York and back faster. But I must say, they should work on the long taxi lines, the long lines at Starbucks. And the long lines at the ticket counter, if we can just hyperloop those people there, we'd be a lot better off. And let's say the Purple Line, this is the best news about the Purple Line in more than a year.
Well, I want to ask you a question directly that we asked folks on Twitter earlier this morning. Which of these three pie-in-the-sky projects would you prefer to see most? One, the Hyperloop. Two, a gondola connecting Georgetown to Roslyn. Three, another bridge crossing the Potomac River to relieve the traffic on the American Legion Bridge.
Well, I believe the bridge across the Potomac, if you never get Maryland involved with it, is probably going to be necessary whether people want it or not. But my fantasy idea is the one that Mary Chay did earlier this year when she put out her annual silly budget, and she suggested that there be hot air balloons to float people from Anacostia across the Potomac River. And I just think the hot air balloon is probably as realistic as the gondolas. And I know the Georgetown bid is going to call me and complain, but the gondola, I just don't see how that's going to be done yet.
So if you've got a preference on Hyperloop, gondola, or bridge,
or write in balloons.
You can tweet us at Kodwo Show. You can write in a balloon, or you can call us at 800-433-8850. You can email us at kodwo@wamu.org, or you can leave a message on our Facebook page. Watch the video stream there. And I should say that Elon Musk, in the last of these tweets, he says, if you want this to happen fast, please let your local and federal elected representatives know. Makes a big difference if they hear from you. Do you think Eleanor Holmes Norton has heard from somebody in the last 24 hours about the Hyperloop?
Well, maybe Elon Musk himself should contact those officials, and I'd love to hear what Ms. Norton has to say about it.
And she joins us now by telephone. Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton is a member of the United States House of Representatives. She's a Democrat representing the District of Columbia. Eleanor Holmes Norton, thank you so much for joining us today.
Always a pleasure, and I can tell you that the Congress can help you with hot air balloons.
Fly that over in the Congress. Aren't you on one of the transportation committees?
I am, and I must say, because I'm a ranking member of the subcommittee that would have jurisdiction, I don't think the reason I haven't heard about it is because I'm a Democrat. I think that this forward thinking doesn't get to the Congress before it gets to the localities. It only gets to us when somebody says, pony up the money.
Well, you know, it is serious that we've got to do a better job of our mass transits, whether it's hot air balloons or vacuum tubes shooting people across the country. But we do have to be more serious about it in the Congress, too.
You're so right. In fact, we're stuck in the 20th century. The rest of the world, certainly the worst, Western world, is doing fast tracks, and they don't do it in 29 minutes as Musk wants to do it. But they could, and in Europe, do that distance in an hour and a half. Why can't we do it here? They do it there.
Can we? Is this an open-ended thing? We can ask you anything we want. I want to ask about guns. You know, the Congress is. You want to turn it into the OK Corral up there and let anybody with a gun permit come up to the Hill. You're having a little battle with Tom Massey from Kentucky, who wants this city.
This guy won't give up, and I'm not going to give up either. Here he wants to say anybody with a concealed carry permit can conceal carry in the District of Columbia. So I put out a release today, and I've been chatting him all along, daring him, because there's a bill about to go to the floor that would allow this to happen, the legislative a subcommittee bill that he could actually attach this to. I'm challenging him to make this concealed carry apply to the Congress of the United States and to federal buildings, including those in Kentucky where he's from.
Tom, I want to let you ask the next question here about this issue, but I should mention right out of the gate that the next edition of Kodjo and Your Community is going to explore this issue. It's going to happen next Tuesday on July 25th at George Mason University's campus in Arlington. It's free and open to the public. You can find all the information about it at kodjoshow.org/events. And we're hoping to have a really vibrant conversation about guns and the law next Tuesday. Tom.
Ms. Norton, have you spoken directly to him? I'm just wondering sometimes when you're on the Hill and you've got 435 members of the House and you can actually look Mr. Massey in the eye, do you get any kind of response from him?
Because he's on one of my committees. It's very interesting how personal relations operate in the Congress. I remember not long ago being actually having a good conversation with Tom, one of those kind of say-nothing conversations. You see a member, you say, how you doing? You know, it didn't come up. It didn't come up because he's doing this for reasons having nothing to do with the substance. He's doing it because he can. He's been going after our guns for some time, and the NRA is now trying to get concealed carry in the Congress. What they're trying to say is if you have a concealed carry from your jurisdiction, you can conceal carry anywhere in the United States. They can't get that through, Tom. The reason they can't is because many jurisdictions attach conditions to when you can conceal carry in their state. So you can't just transfer that to the District of Columbia without transferring those conditions. What he wants to do is to say anybody, no matter if you have conditions or not, you can in the District of Columbia conceal and carry a gun. Now, understand who eats, Tom, in the same upscale restaurants that you do, who roams our streets. These are some of those controversial world figures. The notion that there could be somebody with a concealed carry, leave aside our own residents. Imagine a Congress so reckless as to allow concealed carry in the nation's capital.
Okay, I just have to state for the record, I don't go to those upscale restaurants.
I had to put them on you. By the way, you can conceal carry in the District of Columbia. You can get a permit.
Right, if the police chief allows it.
If you can show good cause.
Right, the police chief has to show a reason why you need it. So can you have a new license tag, I understand, that says, leave us alone. that the mayor gave you? I don't know if it's a ceremonial license.
That's ceremonial. The one that most residents are using is hands-off D.C.
Right.
Because at least that mentions
D.C. Can I ask a question about that idea of leaving the district alone?
The host wants to get in on the
question. Well, now there's legislation on the books that's officially gone into effect in the district that would allow doctors to prescribe life-ending drugs to terminally ill patients. A House panel has advanced a measure that would repeal the Death with Dignity law. It was introduced by Maryland Representative Andy Harris. Can you fill us in on where things are going from here and what you're trying to do about it?
Sure. I've been able to stop Death with Dignity thus far. It was first introduced as a bill and failed to get, indeed it did, in fact, get a hearing in our committee, did not get to the House floor, and has never even been considered by the Senate. Why? I think one of the major reasons why is that six states, indeed 24 Republican House members, have medical aid in dying in their state. So this would be another one of those embarrassments. Usually they don't mind such embarrassment. But it's such a serious bill that after it came out of committee in the House, they were not even able to get it to the House floor. I think we can stop this because I don't think the Senate is going to take up a bill or allow it to be attached to our appropriation. That's where we are now. Andy Harris of Maryland, the only Republican in Maryland, has demagogued Death and Dignity in a way I've never seen it before with what I can only call lies, saying that if you're a tourist, you could get Death with Dignity, saying that you could somehow have a doctor inject you. This is medicine that someone who has no hope of living after 6 months can get after two physicians have indicated they're about to die.
It must be selfish.
But I think most people don't know that 73% of the polls show that 73% of Americans are for Death with Dignity. And this bill has been introduced as a national bill to allow it nationally twice before and failed twice before. That's one of the reasons I think I can keep this from happening.
And Tom, it's my understanding that there are now three doctors in the district that have signed up to be able to prescribe.
That's correct. And I think it's also important to point out that the law, D.C. law for Death with Dignity, is that you must self-administer, that you cannot be in such a state that someone else can inject you or make you drink something to die, that you must self-administer it. So it's another check on somebody abusing this process.
And, Tom, this is one of those rare instances where I think D.C. has beat the Congress because the mayor, realizing, and she and I have talked, that this isn't, that D.C. Death with Dignity is still law, that only the House has overturned it, so she is now in the process of implementing the regulations.
There's a window right now for people to take advantage of the law. I've actually spoken to a representative of someone who is terminally ill, may not be 6 months, but she is going to get the medicines. She is not going to take it immediately because she wants, like everyone, wants to live. She's going to continue her treatments, but she says she wants to be able, at the moment it comes, but she thinks she's waging a battle that's already lost, she wants to be able to end her life with some dignity.
Autonomy over her own life.
Right.
And it's important to note, Tom and Michael, that in the experience of the six states who have this law is that most people do not, in fact, use a law. They go into hospice. But obviously they have achieved some comfort at the end of their life by understanding that their life was in their own hands.
We're talking with Eleanor Holmes Norton. She's a member of the United States House of Representatives. She's a Democrat who represents the District of Columbia. If you got questions for her, you can reach us at 800-433-8850. You can tweet us at Kojo Show or email us at kojo@wamu.org. I'm Michael Martinez, sitting in for Kojo Namdi today, joined in the studio by our resident analyst, Tom Sherwood, a reporter for NBC4, a columnist for the Current Newspapers. And Congresswoman Norton, we have a question here from Jose, who I believe wants to ask you about another issue that Congressman Harris has been involved with involving the District of Columbia. Jose, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Great. Yeah, I'm a resident of Ward 5, and I voted during that election 2 years ago to legalize marijuana in the district. And we're leaving hundreds of millions of tax dollars on the table by not having autonomy in this issue. And I'm just wondering you know, what's the progress on that in Congress? And do you see a path forward, you know, maybe with the debt ceiling coming up or anything like that of legalizing here in the district?
Thanks for your question, Jose.
Thank you for that question, because it does allow me to point out that there are a number of riders. Death with Dignity may be the most high profile, but marijuana is one of the riders, so-called attachments to our appropriation, that is among the most abusive and the greatest abuser. The Death with Dignity abuser, Andy Harris, is also an abuser on marijuana legalization because of a hole I found in Congress's attempt to overturn even legalization. Marijuana is legal in the District of Columbia, a couple of ounces. But what is not legal is the ability of the District of Columbia to regulate marijuana. What is not legal is the ability of the District of Columbia to tax marijuana, as is done in the more than half dozen states which have similar laws. So, yes, they have included this rider, and as the appropriation process proceeds to the floor, I will put amendments on the floor to strip that rider from the D.C. appropriation.
Is there any half measure? Can you just say any monies collected by the district in the regulatory scheme would be used for public health or whatever, just to give Andy Harris some kind of fallback position where he might not just be 100% against it?
You can't, because you'd have to speak directly to the rider. You'd have to erase the rider.
Okay. We can't do it.
It's difficult to do, but it's not impossible. Remember, Tom, we had a rider for almost 10 years. It perhaps did the most harm, that said we couldn't use needle exchange.
Right.
We kept going at it. That rider is gone, and we have been able to dramatically reduce HIV/AIDS that came from needles.
And I should mention that we did invite Congressman Harris to join the broadcast when he's ready to do so. We have not heard back from him yet, but we will continue to request that Andy Harris join our program and talk about these issues.
May I ask, this is the politics hour.
Love it when he says that.
I had nothing to do this morning, so I went on the Federal Elections Commission to look at your campaign finance reports. Are you there?
I am. I haven't looked, but go ahead.
You don't have very much money in there, so it's under $100,000. And it is listed, though, for 2018, so you haven't had any kind of big party announcing your reelection bid, have you? Did I miss it?
Actually, I went. It's funny you should mention, you know, members of Congress have to raise funds for the entire 2 years. Typically, you don't raise most of your money in the first of the 2 years. We raise it in the second of the 2 years. But I always begin early, and I was over at the DNC just yesterday, dialing for dollars, and that's what we're going to have to do until we find another way to be elected. So I've never been short of money when it comes to running.
And so you are definitely you're running for reelection. You were first elected in 1990. Is that correct? 1990.
That's right.
A couple of decades ago. What's your long term plan?
To keep running for election.
Well, Tom, I want to ask the Congresswoman about a separate piece of legislation that she's working on. And I learned about this because I saw a photo of you on Twitter standing in a small park behind a bush looking like you were up to no good. And I learned from this that there are nearly 300 small parks in the district that are overseen by the National Park Service, which they struggle to maintain. You've offered a bill to improve one of them, Franklin Square Park in downtown D.C., What's this about?
Yeah, this is really unusual, and the district asked me to do it. The district wants something we don't have, but apparently other states have it, cooperative management agreement, so that if there's a park that we would like to upgrade, we don't have to go to the National Park Service, which is the most underfunded agency in the federal government, and wait for them to move. The reason this is important for us is because our neighborhood parks are not owned by us, these wonderful parks,
mm-hmm.
owned by the National Park Service in whatever your neighborhood you live. And it's all they can do to keep them up, and they do. They plant flowers, they plant grass, and mow the lawns. But Franklin Park is in the middle of the town. It's a really run-down park. What the district wants to do is something that I would call an offer that the Congress cannot refuse. That's why I think I can get this one done. The district has teamed with the downtown BID. What's the BID?
Downtown
Business Improvement District.
And BID says we want to put flowers there, we want to put amenities there, we want to put new benches there. But we can't do it because only the National Park Service can do it. So I'm saying to the National Park Service, forget about the money. We'll fund it. And they're saying, look, we'd like to do it, just get this bill passed. Now, have you ever heard of a bill where the local jurisdiction says, we want to give money to the federal government to fix a federal facility? That's what the district is saying, and that's what I think I can get done on this one.
I know we're running short of time, but this is a much larger thing than these 292 spits of land that I did a story on this week. The mayor's letter to the President Trump said the city would like the legal control of RFK properties, which are just leased from the Interior Department. She'd like control of Franklin Park, as you mentioned, but also the three golf courses here in the city, saying that the district can take care of these properties and monetize them for the benefit of the citizens and the tourists here. So it's a big change if some of these properties switch.
We can do something. We certainly can do something, and I'm working now on the golf courses, which I've been trying to upgrade ever since I came to Congress. We can't do anything on RFK. The reason is what the mayor wants, and we've informed her that this is impossible.
Oh, this is news. What?
Yeah, she wants to put housing and things the district needs on RFK. That is verboten. You can't take federal land, that is a National Park Service land, and build apartments on it. If you could, there are about six states in the United States where most of the land in those states, like Montana, Nevada, are owned by the federal government. They would be the first to say, you ain't not going to do it in D.C. unless you let us build some housing on our land. But we can get cooperative agreements on things like the golf courses, and we're working right now with the district on that.
Okay, well, then the housing can be built on the D.C. general land and other places, and then,
thank you for raising that. Right. That is because of a bill I passed that said in which we were able to trade district land for federal land. That I was able to get through the Bush administration. But what she wants is, and what we're working on, I should say for your listeners, we're working on a new agreement for RFK so that we can upgrade that facility and make use of it. You know, it's a phantom facility now.
Right. It'll be the future home of the Washington Redskins if the mayor has her way.
Only if they change their name.
Congresswoman Norton, I know we're short on time, but there is one last question I want to ask you because his name's come up a couple of times, and this is a different kind of question. I understand you've recently introduced legislation with Congressman Andy Harris that would honor Frederick Douglass. Next year is going to be the 200th anniversary of his birth. How did this come about, and what's it been like working with him collegially on this?
Well, I wish everybody would know this. Andy Harris is the worst member of Congress when it comes to trying to override our bills. And yet, and this is how Congress ought to operate, everybody, and yet Frederick Douglass lived both in Maryland and the district, lived most of the time in the District of Columbia. So when I put in a bill to mark the bicentennial of Frederick Douglass's birthday, I think I'm able to get that. He's such an admired figure. Andy Harris wanted to be a co-sponsor. Well, I'm not going to say you abuser, you thug abuser of the District of Columbia. I don't want to be associated with you. I'm looking for ways to work with Republicans. And this is a Republican that wants to work with us on something we want. He'll help me get it to the floor. We also have a Senate sponsor, Chris Van Hollen. That's the way the Congress ought to be operating, and I must tell you, it sure isn't operating that way now, except for this small exception that I'm proud of.
Okay, well, I think we're pretty much out of time. If this concealed carry thing happens, I want you to let me know when you're packing heat so I can see it up on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, that's right. Only mine will be out in the open. I'll go after Republicans.
Thank you very much for your time, Congresswoman Norton. Really appreciate it.
Of course.
That was Eleanor Holmes Norton, a member of the United States House of Representatives, a Democrat representing the district. In just a few moments, we're going to be talking with John Whitbeck, the chair of the Virginia Republican Party. So if you've got thoughts or questions about the state of the race for governor in Virginia, now's the time to start sharing those with us. You can call 800-433-8850. You can email kojo@wamu.org. You can tweet us at Kojo Show. But before we talk about Virginia, Tom, there are a few questions that I want to ask you about Maryland, because there are some candidates in waiting, so to speak, one in a statewide race, a few in a more local race. Maya Rockeymoore, a policy consultant who's married to longtime U.S. Congressman Elijah Cummings, may be soon running for governor. What should we be looking at here?
Well, she's been very active. She has her own consulting firm, politically active apart from her husband. She has her own identity. And the idea, and she's told people this past week that she's been looking at possibly running for office. And, you know, Elijah Cummings himself was thinking about that Senate race but didn't get into it. Mm-hmm. And so if she were to jump into the governor's race,
how would that affect this race?
Well, if I were Ben Jealous, I'd be horrified. Because that's in the same general geographic area for his campaign. And, you know, Donna Edwards, who's thinking about
running. And there aren't any women.
Right, I was just going to bring this up. Donna Edwards brought it up here that, you know, there are no women leaders, elected women leaders, essentially, in the state of Maryland. I think there's one county executive out of all the counties. You know, the governor, the Senate, all these places are men. So if Rockeymoore gets in, it would just be extraordinary. She said she won't take a long time, and she will be announcing what she's going to do. It just has unsettled. There's lots of unsettled politics in Maryland. This is one of the big ones.
And you mentioned Donna Edwards. There was a piece in the Washington Post this week about her speaking at a union hall earlier in the week, where she seemed an awful like a candidate who's going to be running for county executive next year.
She'll be actually running before the end of this year. But, you know, here on this program, the Politics Hour, after she gave up her House seat to run for the Senate and then lost to Van Hollen, she sat right here and talked about how she was going to visit the national parks to decompress from being public service, but mm-hmm. also wouldn't disabuse us. So when I asked her if she would run for county executive, it would be a very big deal if she got in. See Anthony Muse, the state legislator.
Yeah, what kind of race is looking in front of her?
He's in. And the big news, of course, is that the county prosecutor, the state's attorney, Angelo also Brooks, is strongly expected to get into this race in the next couple of weeks. So we could have one heck of a race in Prince George's County for county executive. Rashern Baker, term limited, is also running for governor.
From Maryland into Virginia right now, we're joined in the studio by John Whitbeck. He's the chair of the Virginia Republican Party.
Nothing is going on.
And in Virginia, where there's going to be a big debate tomorrow in Hot Springs. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
What do you make of how the race is looking right now?
Well, you know, I think both sides got to face the truth that it's a toss-up. I think, you know, Republicans haven't won a statewide race in a long time. And the Democrat Party's lack of message puts them at a real disadvantage. They have been decimated nationally. I think the massive financial advantage that Ed Gillespie has is a big deal right now. But we think it's a toss-up. We're going to run it like a toss-up to the end. We don't care what the polls show. They show them tied. But Virginia public polling is garbage, and we just don't even look at it, and we just go forward and do our thing.
Tom Sherwood.
Well, it's the Virginia Bar Association.
And you should know that Tom told me before the show that if it weren't in Hot Springs, he would have thought a little bit harder about going, and he's lamenting that people aren't holding more debates that are closer to his house.
I'm very suspicious of Mr. Whitmore. If I were the state party chairman of Virginia, I'd already be at Hot Springs.
Well, I'm leaving right from here. Okay. I'm headed right down to the homestead, which is beautiful.
You know, there was a little back and forth over the candidates, Ed Gillespie, the Republican candidate, and Ralph Northam. But they've set out a couple of debates. I think Channel 4 is doing one of the debates in Fairfax County later in the year. If you could just articulate what the significant difference is between the two, and how can Mr. Gillespie, who had a scare with Corey Stewart, how he's going to run his campaign now to make sure that doesn't happen again with Mr. Northam.
Well, I think there's significant differences. We are seeing the nomination of the three most extreme progressive candidates that Virginia's ever had. Ralph Northam supports driver's licenses for illegal immigrants. Ed Gillespie opposes it. Ralph Northam cast the vote to reject the bill that would have outlawed sanctuary cities in Virginia. Ed Gillespie says he would have signed the bill. Ed Gillespie wants to cut taxes. He has a 10% across the board tax cut for income taxes. Ralph Northam has voted for massive tax increases his entire career, meals taxes, transportation tax increases, everything you can think of, taxing Airbnb, for crying out loud. Ralph Northam has no actual policy message. It's all about, I don't like Donald Trump, and I want nothing to do with Trump's agenda, and he's a narcissistic maniac, he's mentally ill and whatnot. Ed Gillespie, on the other hand, has talked about how he wants to work with the administration, how he can work with the administration. Great story a couple days ago. Ed Gillespie was down in Norfolk at one of the largest, if not the largest, naval power locations in the world, and talked about how I'm going to be able, as governor, to work with the administration to keep Norfolk as the most powerful naval station in the world. And Ralph Northam attacked him for it, which was bizarre. I mean, they're trying so hard to lump him in with Trump that they sort of lost sight of the fact that he was talking about making sure that Hampton Roads continues to be the naval superpower that it's been traditionally. We love it when they do that, so we hope they keep that. I hope that's their campaign, because it's going to work well for us.
Well, what do you think the campaign's relationship with Trump should be? He didn't win in Virginia last year, as you mentioned at the beginning of the show. It's been 8 years since Republicans won a statewide election in Virginia. How do you see the president's political brand affecting this gubernatorial race here in Virginia in the fall?
Yeah, I get asked that a lot, and I'm on the side that believes that when you hold the White House, you have to use the prestige and the power of the presidency to your advantage in politics. I mean, you just do. Ed Gillespie should never compromise what he believes in at any point, and he never has. He's always been pretty straightforward. But look, the president's all in for Ed Gillespie. I've been in the Oval Office, talked to him myself about it. He's all in for Ed Gillespie. And should be. This is a tremendously important race for Virginia. It may be the most important in our state's history, because it's really going to determine what direction Virginia is going to go. Are we going to continue the war on coal in Southwest Virginia if Ralph Northam is elected, which the president is really interested in? Are we going to continue to degrade our veterans and hurt our military the way the Obama, McAuliffe, and Northam administrations have done? What the president has talked about. Are we going to build infrastructure? Are we going to reform our tax code? All the things the president has talked about, Ed's talking about as well. And the Republican Party has the greatest number of elected seats nationwide in 95 years. And it's all due to the fact that we've had a message that's resonated across the country and will resonate in Virginia, and the Democrats haven't.
Ed Gillespie has Mr. Gillespie has pursued a campaign and through the primary very similar to what Larry Hogan, the Republican governor of Maryland, has done, where he has focused on state issues and pretty much didn't even say President Trump's name and said, I'm not going to be drawn into these various issues of national. I'm trying to be the governor of Maryland. And then up until this week, Mr. Gillespie has pretty much done the same. But this week he started talking about being having President Trump maybe come to Virginia and campaign for him. But, you know, I'm looking at the television set where Sean Spicer has resigned as the press secretary for the White House, and we don't have to enumerate all the things that have been going on with President Trump. His approval ratings, as Mike just mentioned, are not very good. Is it better for Mr. Gillespie to focus on Virginia and not the National Republican Party?
I would agree with that, yes. I think not to take away from the importance of the president's help in this race, but this is a Virginia race. This is about Virginia issues. One of the things that I think the Democrats are mistakenly trying to do is to nationalize this race, make it all about Trump. You could see from the money coming in, most of it's coming from out of state. They're trying to nationalize it on down to our House of Delegates races, which, as you know, are going on this year as well. And their whole message is, we don't like Donald Trump.
Tom Perriello did not succeed trying to make it a national Democratic race. He lost to Mr. Northam.
He did. And I think whichever candidate connects with Virginia voters is the one that's going to win. There's no question that the national politics of the day color Virginia elections. We are too close to Washington, D.C. here in Northern Virginia. You know, if there's a government shutdown, for example, that was a devastating impact on Ken Cuccinelli in 2013. Right. So things like that. Look, and Ed Gillespie, you're not going to see him campaigning on a drain the swamp message like the president does, because, look, I mean, I live in Northern Virginia. I live in Loudoun County. I'm an attorney. A lot of my clients are government workers. We all respect that we have thousands and thousands of government workers in Northern Virginia. Ed Gillespie gets that. He's from Fairfax.
Yeah, we're so, swampies.
Well, look, I mean, you know, I'm very proud to live here. I'm very proud that, the federal government feeds the Virginia economy. You know, Virginia is a better place to live because we are so close to this wonderful city, Washington, D.C. You know, draining the swamp is an idea about changing the way we do business in Washington, which I'm all for. But, you know, Virginia is a different place. I mean, we have five distinct regions in Virginia that are almost like different states. And you got to run really five campaigns in each of those areas. And I think Ed Gillespie understands that. And I think one of the ways that you're going to see Ed differentiate himself from his opponent is talking about actual policy. Ed has laid out really detailed policy initiatives, and we're going to see a lot of that tomorrow at the debate.
We got a call right here from John in Arlington, who I think has a specific question about what Republicans can do to court voters in Northern Virginia. John, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I mean, I very much appreciate this last point about the importance of taking the you know, discussion away from being a national issue. Living in Northern Virginia, I have a number of friends who are potential Republican voters and have voted Republican in the past, but especially in this last presidential election and even the gubernatorial election, have said, you know, this Republican Party just doesn't appreciate those of us in Northern Virginia. And as much as people talk about a war on coal, there seems to be a war on Northern Virginia. And almost, you know, this almost belief that in order for, you know, in order for one region of the state to win, another region of the state needs to lose. And this has been a tremendous advantage to the Democrats in, you know, the Northern Virginia area. I'm wondering what the Republican Party will be, you know, saying in order to win voters in this area, but then also how will that message resonate with people in the other portions of the state who might see, you know, state elections as sort of zero sum between regions?
Okay, John, thanks for your call. John Whitbeck.
Yeah, what a fantastic question. Sums up the dilemma that the Republican Party faces in every election that's statewide in this Commonwealth. I mean, as I said, we're very different regions. You know, and being a Northern Virginia voter myself, I uniquely understand, you know, when we're sitting in traffic every day, these are the struggles. You know, when I got less time with my kids because I got more time on the road, infrastructure, you know, tax reform, the economy, the kind of hits that we take in the real estate market, different things. I mean, this is, you know, Northern Virginia is uniquely situated, being that it is so close to the federal government, that we have unique set of circumstances. One of the things I think that Ed Gillespie brings to the table is an understanding of those issues in Northern Virginia, the understanding that, you know, federal workers are an important part of our economy up here, the understanding that transportation is really what people are looking for. You know, in my home county of Loudoun County, one of the issues that absolutely drives people to the polls is the greenway and the overwhelming tolls that are charged. I mean, people talk about building greenway alternatives, building a second bridge over from Loudoun County into Montgomery County. Transportation dominates the discussion in Northern Virginia. And the candidate that has the best plan and the best the best message on that issue, I think, is going to be the one that does well.
Do you want that second bridge?
What's that?
Do you want that second bridge?
You know, I'm not a policy guy. I'm a mechanics guy. I'm all about door knocking and phone calling. But I'll tell
you,
we can
ask you about Hyperloop to New York, too.
You at least ought to look. At least ought to look at it.
Well, right. Absolutely. And my own state delegate, Randy Minshew, put in a bill to study that two sessions ago, and I support that 100%. But I think what we need to do is look at ways that we can reduce these tolls. I mean, that, I'll tell you, you talk about one issue that we hear at the doors when we're knocking. It's the fact that you have to pay, you know, $25 by the time you're done counting the express lanes to get down Reston or East. And that's something that I think the candidate that has the best message on transportation in Northern Virginia is the one that's going to do the best.
We're talking with John Whitbeck. He is the chairman of the Virginia Republican Party. You can join our conversation by calling 800-433-8850, tweeting us at Kojo Show, going on to Facebook and leaving a question or comment on our live video stream there, or by emailing us at kojo@wamu.org. I'm Michael Martinez, sitting in for Kojo Namdi today, joined in the studio by Tom Sherwood, our resident analyst, a reporter at NBC4, who's about to ask the next question.
Yes, well, you didn't mention hot air balloons. I don't know if you heard the show earlier. We were talking about, you know, hot air balloons from Roslyn to Georgetown. But but and also, you sit here, you're a lawyer, right?
I am.
Who it's an easy guess in this region. But, you know, you don't sound either vicious or ruthless. Now, bring that up.
Who said that?
Oh, yes. Who is that? Corey Stewart, who nearly knocked off Ed Gillespie, has jumped ahead into the U.S. Senate race to oppose Tim I keep saying the wrong name. Tim Kaine. I want to say McCain. I got them all mixed up. Anyway, it's just the words vicious and ruthless got me confused there. He's running for a Senate race next year when the Republican Party in Virginia is aggressively trying to stay active on the governor's race. What effect is Corey Stewart's Senate campaign going to have on the Republicans in November?
Well, I think this is an interesting debate that we've been having internally is and there's going to be more than Corey Stewart. I know of at least three other candidates who are going to announce eventually over the course of the next few months. At least that's where they are now. If you are a Corey Stewart supporter, the most important thing that you can do to help your candidate win in 2018 is win the governor's race in 2017.
And pay attention to the House races.
That's right.
The delegate
because
races.
let's be real. If we don't win a statewide race in 2017, the Republican Party, we're a blue state. I have to argue, I have to have some credibility behind my arguments when I say we're a swing state. And having lost seven straight statewide races, the Virginia Republican Party's got a lot to get done this year if we're going to do it. So if you're a Corey Stewart supporter, and I'm talking to you folks in Prince William County, and you want to see your guy in 2018 be the next senator from the great Commonwealth of Virginia, we got to win this governor's race because nobody's going to take seriously that Virginia's a top 10 targeted state for winning that Senate race if we don't demonstrate we can do it in 2017.
Can I just follow up? Because when I said vicious and ruthless, we were referring to Corey Stewart's announcement that he's going to run. He said he's going to run a vicious campaign, a ruthless campaign. Where do you think that fits into the Virginia way of politics?
And can you describe what the Virginia way is?
The Virginia way is that you be aggressive, but there's a certain gentlemanliness and politeness that goes with being a public official and a candidate for office, and that you it's not vicious and ruthless. It might be aggressive, but it's not mean-spirited, which is what that suggests, at least to me.
Yeah, you know, and it's unfortunate in our current system this is going on. I mean, you know, one of the things that I'm just shocked with, you know, we talk about the Kathy Griffin severed head event. We talk about, you know, the quote-unquote resistance. And even down here, when I was down in Washington, D.C. for my RNC meeting, the profane signs that are made of the president and the language. I mean, the DNC chair never misses a chance to use a four-letter word when he's speaking. We've deteriorated our political discourse significantly, and I don't want to see that happen in Virginia. You know, Ralph Northam and Ed Gillespie, at this end of the day, want the same thing, what's best for our Commonwealth. They have totally different ideas how to deal with it. And myself and my wonderful counterpart on the Democrat side, she is such a class act. We have a very good relationship. We totally disagree on everything just about. But that's
sounds like a marriage.
Yeah, right.
Sorry. Yeah.
Well, my wife will tell you that. It used to be a situation where, you know, in my legal profession, same thing. You know, you could disagree during the day and you go out and you have a beer together. And I really would like us to get back to that. I hope this era of polarization really goes away quickly. It's just not something that we need to continue doing. Having said that, people in Virginia and the American people want a fighter. They're tired of politics as usual. They're tired of their own party and my party betraying them. We have three senators right now who are refusing to vote to repeal Obamacare, who campaigned on joining with us in repealing Obamacare. And people are just tired of it. And that's why the drain the swamp and all these messages are so effective, is because people are tired of politics as usual in Washington. That trickles down into Virginia, and politics as usual in Richmond. Fortunately, in Richmond, we get things done. You know, we have a balanced budget because we have to under our Constitution. Transportation is always a struggle, but we try to tackle that every year. We don't have the kind of gridlock that we have in Washington. And, you know, people want a fighter, and you can be a fighter without being angry and obnoxious and using profanity.
Well, can I ask you a question about where that leaves somebody like Barbara Comstock, who represents the part of Virginia that's your neck of the woods?
Yeah.
What do you feel is the right strategy for her? Because she's put some distance between herself and the administration at the same time. She has to hold on to the voters who are enthusiastic about the party. Democrats are really enthusiastic about the chance of picking up her seat next year.
Not going to happen.
Where does she go from here? Why not?
I don't know how many times she has to blow out her opponents before people say that seat's out of play. Every year they attack her. They say nasty, sexist, horrible things about her. There's a group here and a group there that pops up, and they yell and scream about Barbara Comstock and this and that. She's just like Trump, even though she's everybody, you know, on the right, people say she's distancing herself from Trump. She's the hardest working woman in politics. She knocks doors. She makes phone calls. She raises incredible amounts of money. She's highly respected on the Hill. Right as a freshman congresswoman, she walked right in as if she'd been there for 20 years. This is a superstar in the Republican Party. And look, do I agree with her on the distance from the president? I don't. I think that as Republicans, we got to support our president. But Barbara Comstock, I don't know what she has to do to get the respect she deserves as a candidate and as a legislator. She's everywhere. She doesn't sleep. I get emails from her at 3 a.m. It's amazing. She's talking about issues and asking me how she can help us win. She's all in for Ed Gillespie. I mean, you know, I can't say enough good things about her. But the Democrat, you want to throw money away? Go right ahead. We'll do it again.
Her biggest opponent is the changing demographics of Northern Virginia. Some of the
I guess, but yeah. She is
that's
super
longer term.
Well, but she is super popular in the Indian American, South Asian, and Muslim communities in Northern Virginia. You know, I went with her right after the November election to the Adams Center, one of our largest mosques. Reiterated, you know, how welcoming we wanted to be in the 10th District and in Virginia as a whole. She's super popular in the Indian American community. A lot of people don't realize in Loudoun County and Western Fairfax and areas of Prince William how important that community is, how vibrant it is. Some precincts are in the 80s and 90%. We have a wonderful delegate candidate, Subha Kola, raising records amount of money. You should see the finance reports from this gentleman. You've never heard – it's not the usual donors. Nobody knows who these people are. They're all new people that he's bringing into the party. And so I agree with you, Tom, 100%. And it's been one of my top focuses as chairman. We have to focus on bringing our message to new communities. But Barbara Comstock's already doing that, and she has tremendous support in the Asian, South Asian, Muslim, and other communities in her district.
I want to take a call here from Amanda, who is calling, I believe, from Bluemont, Virginia. And it's my understanding she wants to push back a little bit on the idea of where the political tone, where the vulgarity and tone is coming from. Amanda, you're on the air. Go ahead. It's your turn.
Hi. I noticed the gentleman bringing up Kathy Griffin and the DNC chair as reasons for the political discourse falling apart in our country. I noticed that he didn't mention a congressman that hit a journalist or Ted Nugent or our president, who was probably one of the most vulgar people I've ever heard speak, period. I think he started it. I understand that the Republicans were pushing against the PC nature of our political discourse. So I'm wondering exactly, you know, what does he think about the president's discourse?
Okay, Amanda, thank you. Thank you so much for your call. John Whitbeck.
Yeah, you know, I've been very vocal, at least during the campaign, when I disagree with the president and when there's something inappropriate. I've been very, very vocal about that. But I think what's happened and what we've seen, and the president is very frustrated, and the staff, you know, who we're close with, and the RNC is very frustrated with the fact that the president's message can never get out there without it being distilled down by certain segments of the media, turning it on its head. And I'll give you a good example. There was a story that came out recently about Ed Gillespie and talking about how he's being, and this is in the Washington Post. I was at all the meetings related that the story talked about, and it was all about how the RNC and the White House are taking over the Ed Gillespie campaign. It was absolutely fake news. I was at those meetings. I saw it. There is no takeover. There was no frustrations. Everybody's on board with Ed Gillespie. And those are the kind of things the president faces every day. The president has the front page of the Washington Post. If you read it, I read it cover to cover because I do opposition research. If you look at the front page of the Washington Post, all the stories are from unnamed sources close to the conversation, or unnamed sources who heard from this or heard from that. And the White House is very frustrated with the fact that their message is being distilled like that. That never happened in the Obama administration. So the president is forced
don't know about that.
No,
but maybe not to this degree.
Well, Tom, you know better than I do, being that you're in the media. But I will tell you, there is no question this White House faces the most biased media in the history of our republic. It's documented. It's well documented. The chief of staff, Priebus, goes on shows, documents. You know, the first right out of the gate. Fake news story about him removing the bust of Martin Luther King. Well, guess what? I was there last week in the Oval Office. It's still right there, and it looks fantastic.
I don't think the media – I'm not going to defend the media here except to say we obviously do make mistakes. Now, the Washington Post story about the national Republican concern about the Gillespie campaign did almost immediately, within a week and a half, follow Mr. Gillespie changing how he approached President Trump. So maybe there was something to it. Maybe it wasn't as horrific as it was made to be sound by the reporter. Not that so much fake news, but a different interpretation. But I want to ask you about a delegate race, because that's where the fights are. Bob Marshall, veteran member of the House, Prince William County. Danica Rome was on the show, his opponent, Democratic opponent. She's a transgender mother, stepmother, and her campaign is about Route 28 and the horrors of that roadway. What do you think about that race? I haven't heard much from Bob Marshall about it.
And we're running short on time, so if you can answer in about 30 seconds.
Well, the Democrat candidate's smart to talk about those issues, because going head-to-head with Bob Marshall on anything else is going to be very difficult. He consistently wins in a district that's overwhelmingly Democratic. He's going to win again. He always does. And I don't see that race as competitive, but I do commend – I'll give credit where credit is due. Talking about the issues that matter to voters in that district, like Route 28, is the right way to go.
Well, you have to tweet when you're – do you have a Twitter handle?
Absolutely.
What is
Love
it?
Twitter. At John Whitbeck.
Okay. I'll watch it for this debate tomorrow at 11 o'clock.
I'll be there.
Well, John Whitbeck, thank you so much for joining us. John Whitbeck is the chair of the Virginia Republican Party. I'm Michael Martinez, sitting in for Kojo today. Thank you so much for listening. That's it for the show, but there's always more happening online and in person. We'd like your help in shaping a community conversation that Kojo will be hosting next week in Northern Virginia about guns. Where do you think the conversation about gun rights, gun violence, and the law needs to go in the Washington region? Send us an email with the subject line guns. The next edition of Kojo in Your Community will explore that issue on Tuesday, July 25th at George Mason University's campus in Arlington. It's free and open to the public, and we want you to come. You can find all the information about that event at wamu.org/events. Don't forget to meet us back here on the air Monday at noon. We'll meet the local man who wrote a song about every metro station in the entire system. That's from noon till 1 on Monday. Until then, have a great weekend. Tom Sherwood, stay cool out there, man.
I intend to.
It's going to be a hot one. Again, thank you so much for listening. I'm Michael Martinez, sitting in for Kojo. Have a great weekend.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.